Well, good morning, everyone. Welcome to The Librarian, starring Tabitha Pope. My name is Pam Stack. I'm sitting in for Tabitha this morning. Well, we have a very special guest from the UK visiting us right now. It's my honor to present to you a best-selling author and the Authors on the Year Global Radio Network Book Review winner of Book of the Year, Scarlett Cole. Scarlett, welcome to The Librarian. How are you this morning?
I am great, Pam. Thank you so much for having me here today. I'm really excited to be here.
It's a thrill to have you. It's a thrill to have you. I've read your books. What a fabulous writer you are. Congratulations on being named as the top romance book by the book reviewers. I think that's marvelous and very well deserved.
Well, thank you very much. I must admit, it's the first time I've received an award for my writing, so the certificate from Cynthia has pride of place on my desk right now.
Oh, I'm so glad to hear that. Wonderful. Before the show began, you and I were talking. We have some common places, which some commonality in our places, and it always makes me giggle, and I think that, you know, it's synchronicity in its greatest form. We both lived in Miami for a while, so tell me about your experience and what you were doing before you were writing.
Well, that's a really interesting question. I studied engineering to begin with, so I'm actually an engineer, and I always say I'm an engineer first, last, and always. But I worked for Toyota as a car maker for a number of years, and then I got the opportunity to join an international consulting firm. So that's how I found my way not only to North America, but specifically to be working in Miami. And, you know, being a transplanted Brit abroad, you know, it was great to be able to look at all these places, and that's what we have in common. So I know talking earlier, we talked about Coconut Grove and the changes over the last 20 years, South Beach, a lot of the places where the strongest steel is actually set.
I love that. Let's talk about your writing, because it's so different from having to write with your left brain as an engineer. By the way, when you worked for Toyota, did you design cars?
I actually built cars. So I was responsible for press and welded subassemblies, so all the bits of metal that are in the car. And I was responsible for the production of all the parts that came in from Toyota's suppliers. So I spent some time out in Japan at TMC, at Toyota headquarters, and then spent most of my time at the manufacturing plant in Derby.
Wow. How funny. But, you know, you've also done a lot of other things too, haven't you? Your life has not only been about being an engineer. You've done some other interesting things too. Will you tell me about it?
Yeah, sure. So I read a book a long time ago. I think the author's name was Poe Brosnan. I may have got that completely wrong. But it was about these people who had made these huge career choices to just go do something different, like the business executive who quit to be a trucker so he could take his four-year-old son on the road with him, those kinds of stories.
Sure.
And so I've always believed that people are capable of being great at many different things. Now, lots of people choose to focus on one career and stay in that career for life, and that's great because they're good at it and they enjoy it. But I also think, you know, people have a lot more capability to move around into different jobs if they want to. And so, you know, I worked at Toyota. Obviously, I was an engineer. That was my first job. But I worked for a consulting firm. So I was a consultant at one of the big four consulting firms for a number of years, where I was a practice expert in operations and manufacturing. But I also was a senior vice president of marketing and strategy for a multi-billion dollar retailer in Canada before I left to become a writer. So, you know, I've done a bunch of different things at different times. You know, some people have been hugely supportive. Some people have been, what the heck are you doing? This doesn't make any sense.
Right.
Sure. But I think for me, you know, they've been the right choices at the right time. And I've just kind of then capitalized on that if I could.
I think that's marvelous, because all of those experiences and the travels must have shaped your writing also?
Oh, I definitely think so. I think there's a few different pieces that come into play. I think, first of all, setting. You know, I'm a great believer in character as location, or location as a character in your story. And,
sure.
You know, Miami is the place of choice for the Second Circle series, you know, and I really want to bring that to life. And I think, you know, a lot of people do a great job writing books about places they've never been, because, you know, the internet and Google Maps and all of these other things give them great tools to really understand these places. So I don't think it's a disadvantage if you've not been, but I do think it can be advantageous to know these places and know them well. I think from a character perspective as well, just meeting all of these different people from all of these different places. You know, I've worked as far afield as Australia and South America and across Europe, and I've met all these different characters. And I think that feeds into the book too. You know, you can say that certain characters have got little characteristics of lots of different people that you've met along the way.
I bet so. And yes, reading your books, I realize that the location is very much about how you decided to write the Second Circle Tattoo series. And let's start with The Strongest Steel, because that book is the book really that's put you on the map and made you a best-selling author.
Yeah, and it's still a surprise to me that happened, to be honest, because I think when you start out writing, you know, and you look on the internet and you start to try and figure out how you're going to make this career work, you know, only the tip of the iceberg ever even get to be published. You know, there's so many authors working so hard to get their stories heard that, you know, to even get an agent with my first book, I was kind of amazed. But the story itself, I was actually in Miami when I came up with the idea. I'd been playing around with the idea of leaving the retailer that I was working for and giving this a shot, because we were about to move back to England. And, you know, I was in that place of, am I going to try and find a job when I get there? Or should I just use this as an opportunity to write? So I was in Miami on a girls' weekend with my girlfriend, Tina. And I was reading a newspaper article about a tattoo artist who had donated their time to cover up a scar. And I can't remember all of the details now, but I think it was somebody who'd been in a road traffic accident and they wanted to have a tattoo over one of the scars that they had. And it really made me think, you know, why would people want to cover up scars? You know, this notion, if you go back to medieval England, right, the battle scars were just that. They were almost a trophy.
A badge of honor.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
And so I thought, well, you know, maybe the scars are because they have bad memories attached to them. And, you know, that would be a good reason. And so the more I started playing around with this idea, and I was lying on a sun lounger, drinking way too much Prosecco at the time, I think. You know, and this
There's
idea
no such thing as drinking too much Prosecco. I don't care what anyone says.
I think there might be at 10 o'clock in the morning, but that's okay.
No, wait. That goes in a mimosa, baby. You've got it wrong. You've not been trained on
What's the saying? It's 5 o'clock in the world somewhere?
Somewhere, absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
So I was thinking this through. Why would somebody want to have... Why would somebody want to do this? And this character, Harper, started to form in my mind. And then, you know, I started to think, well, why would the tattoo artist care? You know, what would make this so unique an opportunity to them that they felt they could really change this person's life by doing this for them? And so the idea of Trent started to form in my mind. And from there, you know, the character started to grow and develop that, you know, I started to realize that, you know, Trent wouldn't be the kind of character who was just covered in random tattoos. I remember listening to Dave Navarro from Jane's Addiction talk once about how he'll just be out with one of his friends and they'll say something funny and then he'll just go and get something that resembles that moment on his arm. And to him, they're deeply personal stories, but they're a complete random combination of things. And so I thought, you know, that's not going to be Trent. Trent's going to have thought this out. It's going to mean more to him than a series of moments. It's going to be, it's about a journey for him. And so these two characters really started to take shape. And that night, Tina and I were walking to Nobu and we were walking along the boardwalk. And I was like, you know what? I've got to set the book here. Like, this is where I came up with the idea. this is a place I love and has special meaning to me. It's a place I know. You know, they always say writers write what you know. And I was like, okay, well, I know this and I have tattoos, so I kind of get that. And so by the time I got on the plane to go back to Toronto, I had an outline of the story in my head.
It's interesting to hear you talk about this, the development of your characters first, because and then how those characters created the storyline for you, and you had the outline in your head. Scarlett, when you sat down to actually put pen to paper, had you mapped out the story in your head, kind of, sort of, maybe not the details and the arc of the story and how it would end, but did you have a general sense already in your mind, a vision of what your book would look like?
Okay, you're going to laugh at this. When I said earlier that I'm an engineer first, last, and always, I actually had it plotted down to the nth degree. Like, I had a full-blown storyboard. I had character profiles. I had spent days in a tattoo studio doing my research. I went back to the tattoo studio in Toronto where I had my first tattoo done. And they let me spend a couple of days there with them talking, you know, about the tattooing process and their clients. I literally had scene by scene, who's in the scene, what the purpose of the scene is, you know, what the setting of the scene is. You know, if I had any quick thoughts, I very often, as I'm plotting, come up with one-liners that I know have to fit into the scene somewhere. So I made a note of those with an idea to then, you know, writing the book. And, you know, I honestly thought with all of that behind me, writing the first draft was going to be a breeze. And I now know different.
Your characters had something to say about that, didn't they?
Well, you know what? I come back to the engineering thing, but like I thought I knew how to tell a story. And I think this comes down to, as a writer, learning your craft. And this notion of learning how to become a writer is separate from your capability to come up with a good idea, a good story. Yeah. Even if you come up with a great scene by scene outline, it doesn't mean you will still write a great story. And so,
sure, there are mechanics to writing, aren't there? There is a way that you, a very dynamic way that you have to write a story for it to become a book. It's not like you're not doing a narrative and explaining a product to somebody. It's not a canned pitch. You need to engage everyone's emotion, and you need to catch them right on the first or second page, or else you're screwed, pretty much.
Yeah. And so, you know, the basic mechanics that many authors would recite, right? You've got to have a great hook just on a single scene. You've got to have a great hook. You need to have a line that catches people at the end. You shouldn't have huge data dumps in the middle. How do you integrate the details that you need to share in the story into characters' actions, characters' dialogue? You know, how to write dialogue that is real and yet grammatically correct.
And moves the story forward. It can't be static. You can't be having a conversation about, you know, how are you, how's the family, what's happening, and have it go nowhere. There has to be a point to dialogue, correct?
Absolutely. Before I went on submission, I decided to do myself a favor and save every editor on the planet from having to read a poor manuscript. I decided to hire a freelance editor. Tanya Egan Gibson. Tanya Egan Gibson was wonderful. She is the author of How to Buy a Love of Reading, but she also does some freelance editing. And when I posted the job, I actually said, this isn't just about you taking my manuscript and fixing it. I need you to teach me why it needed fixing. And she did an amazing job. We spent tons of time on Skype. You know, she walked me through different things. And so, you know, I took all of that feedback, and I like to think I'm a quick study. So I took all that feedback on board. I did a whole bunch more reading. And then I went back at the story. And the second time I went back at it, I could see the story I was trying to tell really come through in a way that the first draft didn't. And so, you know, when I talk to new writers, or as a pitch was mentor this past year, you know, one of the things I said is, you know, focus on the craft. It's almost more important than coming up with a good idea.
I agree with you. It's interesting to me that you wanted her to tell you why something wasn't working, because failure is a terrific teacher, isn't it?
It is. And you know what? I think when you write, and bearing in mind I've been in industry most of my life, and male-dominated industries at that, where you know, feedback was blunt and fast. You know, as a writer, when you've poured your soul out onto the page, for somebody to say, yeah, but you know what, this sucks, and your sentences here are messy, and this is awkward, and it doesn't progress, and you can feel yourself. I remember when I got that first draft of The Strongest Steel back, and one of my favorite scenes, you know, she put, you know, you should think about this. Do you really need this scene? It doesn't really do anything. And it was this great dialogue between Cujo and Trent, and they were having this really funny moment, and I thought I'd written great comedy. And I went back at it, and I was like, yeah, no, she's right. Like, that, it's got to go.
Yeah.
So I think feedback.
It's hard hearing that. It's hard because, let me tell you, it's better hearing it from your editor, because readers are more brutal if you don't get it right.
Well, this
readers,
is true.
They will cut you right off on those little writing fingers, baby, if you don't get it right the first time. They are, you know, and rightfully so, because that's who you're. You are writing for you because you have to write, but ultimately you wouldn't publish your book if you didn't want someone to read it. So, you know, good for you. Good for you for having a thick skin in the real world. But, yeah, you know, that you learned in the first go, you learned something that probably half the writers are resistant to hearing. So good.
Well, you know what?
You.
I have a funny analogy that the consulting firm I used to work for was huge on feedback. We used to get, you know, semi-annual reviews. You'd be ranked against your peers, and it was kind of a fast delivery. But they used to say that feedback is a bit like getting a sweater from your grandmother for Christmas. and the reason it's like getting a sweater from your grandmother for Christmas is it could be ugly as sin, but it's given with love.
Absolutely.
And, you know, as long as you are working with the right people and you have the right support network, whether it's, you know, your editor at a publisher or a critique partner, or, you know, your sibling, if they can be honest, you know, my sister, you know, is a very good, healthy critic of my work. So she'll tell me what doesn't work, you know, then hearing that feedback, you know, that it's coming from people who actually want you to be successful. And when you think of it that way, it feels a little easier to take. I think
Absolutely.
If you think of it as being attacked,
grab a sweater.
That's different.
Sure.
And I think that
sure.
goes to readers and readers' reviews, right? Like, I have people, I do read my reviews. You know, everybody says you should stay away from them. But I do, because I believe I can learn something from them. And, you know, I think, obviously, I have a healthy respect for the fact that my books are not going to please everybody all the time. I mean, there's no book written to date that will please absolutely everybody who reads it. But I think, you know, some people deliver tough feedback really, really well. And I think, you know, there are
right.
some people who like to crucify you. And I think there are two
different trolls. Right. I agree.
Yeah.
But I've been looking at your reviews. The interesting thing is you've not got hit with a one-star review. So you're still a one-star virgin. when you get the one-star cherry popped, you'll be fine. You'll be stunned. You'll be hurt. You'll cry for a day or two. But then you'll realize that's just a troll. Your books are overwhelmingly popular. And you know, I look at reviews. I look at the worst review first, and I want to see how it is that writer or reader is presenting it. Is it someone who really read the book? Do they understand what you were trying to say? And would they just saying, well, I didn't really like it, and that's okay. But if they're saying something nasty or trying to tell you how to write your book, then I have a tendency to disregard those, and probably you should too. But if you see a pattern, people saying, you know, well, this is what I didn't like, and then you see that over and over and over and over again, that might be something to keep in mind, right? So reading your reviews is not a bad thing if the critique is a legitimate one.
I would totally agree with that. And one of the things I I think I mentioned earlier that I used to be a senior vice president of strategy. And so one of the things I did before I sat down and wrote was I went through the best review and worst review of 500 contemporary romance books. And right. I wanted to understand what do readers love and what do readers hate, because I wanted to know those things going into my book. And some of the things that came through I could fix for. So obviously, I mean, I lived in Canada for a number of years, and I lived in the US for a year before that. So I understand the difference between pavement and sidewalk and eggplant and aubergine. But
right.
For example, you know, one of the things I didn't realize is most people in America don't use a toast rack for reasons I don't fully understand.
I don't even know what that is.
It's a stand, and when you've made your toast, you put the slices in it so they don't get steamy and sticky on top of each other.
I don't know anybody who lets them wait that long. You slap some butter on their baby and eat them. A toast rack? Who has room for that?
Okay, you got to go Google toast rack. One of the things I found was that readers don't like it when non-American authors try to write American stories with American characters and they don't get speech cadence right.
The idioms are different. Yes.
Absolutely. Some countries say, yes, I'm going to the hospital. Some say I'm going to hospital. And that makes a difference to readers.
Or to university or to a university. And university and college are different in the UK than
Absolutely.
They are over here. Whereas they're kind of the same thing. So, yes, I understand that. And, you know, but that's because most people who read in a genre stay in that genre. They don't step outside of it. And that's okay, too. You know, romance drives the market. There's no doubt. And so if you introduce most, I think, authors who introduce dialect from where that's regional, do it successfully because their readers read in multiple genres, so they understand the dialect and it doesn't trouble them at all. I'm fascinated by it. There are some words I don't understand, and I just it's a slang to me that's not familiar. So I just send a PM to the author and say, what the hell does this mean? You know, I'm clueless, but I read cross genres, so it's okay. You know, I have to sometimes look up in the Urban Dictionary what some of the abbreviations are. But I don't mind doing that. I have a dictionary at my side all the time. I'm thrilled to learn new words. But you're right. The typical reader who does not read 400 books a year like I do, or like Cindy does, 200 books a year, you know, they are put off by it. You're absolutely right. It's a brilliant piece of reasoning that you did to go and look at the best and the worst. Perhaps that's why your reviews are overwhelmingly positive. We have
70%
five-star reviews. And
it's amazing, isn't it?
It's brilliant. It's congratulations on that. Let me just take
a
moment to remind everyone that this is a trademark copyrighted podcast solely owned by the Authors on the Air Global Radio Network, LLC. I am speaking to romance phenomenon Scarlett Cole, who is a resident of the world but currently lives back in the UK where she's originally from. If you'd like to say hello to Scarlett, please give us a call at 347-633-9609. That's 347-633-9609. I'm Pam Stack, sitting in for Tabitha Pope of The Librarian. Back with Scarlett now. Scarlett, tell us the basic story of Second Circle Tattoos, and let's have just an overview of that first, and then we're going to take a call from someone I think who's really anxious to talk to you.
Okay. Well, Second Circle Tattoos is a tattoo studio in Miami, and it is owned by Trent Andrews, who is the rock star of tattooing, and he is up and coming, you know, more nationally known. He ends up in the story getting involved in a reality TV show. And our heroine in the first story is Harper Connolly, who is a girl on the run. And the idea for the series came from the couple, but the more I fleshed out the series, I thought, you know what, this is really about the people who work in the tattoo studio. And so there are a number of people who work in the tattoo studio. Obviously, there is focus on a few characters to begin with. So there is Trent and his business partner, Cujo. And there is Leah, who is a
receptionist.
No, that's Pixie. Pixie is the receptionist.
Right.
Yeah. And she is a purple-haired girl that the boys found sleeping rough in the doorway to Second Circle on the day they got to the building. And Leah is the other tattoo artist. There's also Eric. And the reason Eric doesn't play as big a focus is, you know, I wasn't sure how successful the series was going to be. And so I made a plan to keep growing and growing the series. But also didn't want to introduce too many characters too early so that it became confusing to readers.
There you go. I want to bring on to the show the director of our book review, Cynthia Rifle. Cindy, say hi to your favorite author of last year, Charlotte Cole.
Hi, Scarlett. How are you?
Oh, my goodness, Cynthia. It is so great to talk to you.
Well,
thank you so much
for
my certificate. It's got pride of place on my desk.
Let me tell you something. I, and Pam can tell you this is the God's honest truth, I do read around 200 books a year, and I read this book, and I can always tell when a book is a really good book because I have a specific routine when I go to bed at night. I don't let myself take books to bed.
Right.
I put my book down, I go to bed, I get up the next morning, I'll pick it back up again. This was one of the first books last year that I literally was thinking about for an hour and a half after I went to bed, going, I wonder what's going to happen next. Well, I wonder what's going to happen next. Well, I really should go get, no, I can't go get, I have to go to sleep, you know, and then I can get up tomorrow morning. And it was that fascinating to me when I got finished with the book, picked up the phone, called Pam, said, you got to read this book.
Every single day and for months afterward, all she talked about was The Strongest Steel and Scarlett Cole, and you've got to read it. And so I, you know, read the book, and then when I said Scarlett's new book is out, she jumped all over that. Oh, my God. It was just, it was a monumental shift in Cindy's life, reading your book. I'm not joking. And that
it's
is
true.
Probably the highest praise that a reader can give to a writer. I believe.
Oh, it is. It's truly wonderful and incredibly humbling when you get reactions like that from somebody, because you write this book and you nobody intends to put out a bad book, right? Nobody writes a book and thinks,
sure,
you know what, this one's going to get a 2.8 on Amazon and I'm going to be okay with it. But then you start to get this kind of response, and sometimes it starts small. It might be your best friend because they read it, and then you're like, oh, well, you're kind of biased. Or, you know, then you start to get these letters, and then when it starts to become to, you know, industry professionals like yourself who have just read so many books, you know, I read a lot of books and I can't keep them straight, so I have no idea how you ladies do it. But when you then get that kind of feedback from somebody who knows their stuff, you're like, oh my God, I might have pulled this off. Like, maybe I did pull this off.
Well,
the funny
well
thing
you
about
did.
This is, I don't know if you pay that much attention to what's being said about all kinds of stuff on Facebook, but they're constantly talking about book boyfriends. And because I read around 200 books a year, my friend usually lasts for about a week or two. At the most. So I, you know, that's not a deal for me. And when people pop up with that, I'm like, eh. Trent has been my book boyfriend for 7 months now.
Oh,
yeah.
Wow.
I just fell in love with this guy, fell in love with how amazingly generous and thoughtful and considerate and patient and loving that he was with this woman.
Well,
and I thought,
Scarlett,
there aren't that many men who do that.
I have to share something with you, and my audience and my friends know this. I am a certified victim advocate because I'm a survivor of domestic violence. I was stabbed, strangled, and beaten on Christmas night several years ago.
Oh my gosh.
And it's a good thing. It made me who I am today. So Cindy
right.
was just, she said, "You've got to read this book. You've got to read this book." And so having been a victim advocate and seen a lot of things, including the devastation of domestic homicide, I immediately connected with you for figuring it out and for the characters and all. And I have to tell you, in the day and age when I was recovering, there were people who were not that kind and not that considerate, because this was a long time ago. But so Cindy really, nailed it when she said, "Oh, you're going to relate to this book immediately." And she was right. She was right. So kudos to you for telling a very realistic story. Things that I've seen and women that I've worked with, quite honestly. And
well, thank you for sharing that story with us. I think one of the things that's been the most I don't know whether inspiring is the right word, but I got a letter from a reader shortly after the book came out. And you'll have to forgive me because it does sometimes make me a bit emotional talking about it. But I got a letter from somebody through my Facebook page who sent me a letter and said, "I started reading the book and I started to realize that there were some patterns in my own life that were, I was putting myself in Harper's shoes. And so I made a decision and I packed up some bags and I took my kids to my mom's today."
Wow.
And I never in a million years, when I sat down on a sun lounger drinking Prosecco in Miami and came up with the story of these people, thought that a work of fiction that I wrote as an intelligent, hopefully intelligent, interesting, but still beach read, like, it's, something you'd
sure.
take on your holidays and you sit on a sun lounger and you'd enjoy, would have that kind of impact on somebody's life.
Listen.
And it just
of
never
course.
Occurred to me that that would happen. But since then, I've had a lot of letters from people with stories not too dissimilar to your own, Pam, saying a very, very similar thing.
Yeah, it's an amazing thing that, and I'll tell you what it is because you are compassionate about your characters and you were thoughtful and you were real. And sometimes, those who are going through a trauma latch on to a character and see hope where the writer is taking them. And that is the motivation enough. You may have been the only person that she ever told that to. You may have
been the only person.
Yeah. And
quite
so
it took me a while to come up with a response, to be honest. Normally I'm kind of like, here's some hearts and thanks and yay, that's great to hear, right? Because
sure.
I'm genuinely excited about them. But I was just, it stopped me in my tracks. And I came downstairs and I read it to my husband and he's like, "For real?" And I'm like, "Yeah." And we were both just stood in the kitchen like we couldn't absorb that had happened.
Well, you talk to Cindy about it because Cindy was a nurse in an emergency room for a long time. And so she's seen the horrors of domestic violence and intimate partner violence. And so she was keenly aware of what was happening in your book, too. These are conversations. This was a running conversation for 6 months, wasn't it, Cindy?
Yeah, it was.
Yeah.
Wow.
It really was.
So, you really don't understand the impact of your – that's why I hope that when, I guess, someone – a writer creates a scene where a woman is victimized, I hope they don't do it frivolously. I hope they recognize that what is – it's not thrown in for shock value, that they recognize that someone may be reading their book and will have a visceral, emotional response to it. And so I think you handled it with dignity and respect, and that's why your reader wrote to you. So kudos for you. I mean, double snaps.
Thank you.
You earn another award just for that, as far as I'm concerned. So
I agree, because I have to tell you, one of the things that really nailed me through this whole book was the fact that she was wanting to get these tattoos placed on her back because that's where the guy had written these things on her back.
Tell the story.
Well, but
she wanted to have
true.
A
I'm sorry. I know.
Right. Anyway. She wanted a cat as a result of
the
abuse.
The thing about it was that it was so hard because of her previous abuse for her, A, to let any man touch her, and B, even worse than that, to let anybody come at her with her back to them.
Yeah.
Right.
And for him to immediately pick up on that and to be able to walk her through that and to help her be able to do that, that was another thing that really, really caught
me. It's very real. Yeah, it was very real. The instance of PTSD was very real, in my humble opinion. You were delicate. You were very real, and it wasn't disingenuous. It wasn't for the titillation factor. So, I'm always happy when I see that. If you're going to write the story, don't be gratuitous about your victim or your survivor. So, you did a great job on that, Scarlett, I have to tell you. Running out of time. I have to tell you, I'm so glad Tabitha couldn't make it today. And that Cindy and I have a chance to talk to you. I can't wait to send her a text and say, na-na-na-na-na-na, I got to talk to Scarlett. Scarlett, will you come back maybe on my show, Authors on the Air, one day, and let us chat a little bit more? I'm going to bring Cindy back. She is the expert on all things Scarlett right now. But I do have something I like to do at the end of all my interviews, and it's something called Final Five. It's five quick questions and five quick answers. Are you game? It's kind
absolutely.
Of all in Stump the Author. I guess I should have said that first. Okay, so what's the thing about hoarding mason jars?
Again, it comes back to being an engineer. To create time to write, I need to be very organized, and to do that, I have a week rotating 4-week meal plan, and I batch make mason jar salads, and I batch make soup at the weekend, and so all the lunches are good to go. I have a snack station set up with almonds and pistachios.
Oh, you're
and
just, honey, that's not being an engineer. That's OCD. I'm sorry.
And Pam would know.
That's not being an engineer. That's OCD. You're crazy.
No, it's about operations. It's about being efficient, right?
Yeah,
I never have to worry about what I'm having for dinner.
You have a factory in your kitchen.
I do.
So the top of your bucket list must be buying expensive shoes. What's the most expensive pair of shoes that you've ever purchased?
Do you want the real truth?
Yeah.
So the most expensive pair of shoes I ever bought was a limited edition pair of Jimmy Choo, because I got the opportunity to go to a Robert De Niro premiere. And I decided that if I was going to go to this premiere, I like Jimmy Choo and Manolo Blahnik and all these other names. And I bought a very, very expensive pair of Jimmy Choo. But the good news is I ended up 3 feet away from Robert De Niro and Edward Norton in my fancy shoes.
And how much were the shoes?
Oh, really? My husband will kill me. I hope my husband's not listening. They were over $1,000.
Oh, my God. You have a sickness, woman. God bless you.
I can't afford those on a writer's salary, though. They're just a nice reminder of a life I used to have.
Encase them in a Lucite case and leave them on your shelf. That's pretty cool. De Niro, not so much, but being next to Edward Norton, I'd kind of get a thrill out of that too. So you've traveled around the world. What's one place that you haven't gone to that you would love to go?
I would like to walk along the Great Wall of China, and I want to go to Venice.
Oh, Venice is fabulous. I have not
I've
walked
been to
the
Rome, I've been to Milan, I've been to all kinds of places in Italy, some with work, some for travel, but I've never made it to Venice.
Well, you're going to love it. It's fabulous. It's very, very romantic. The roses growing along the canals are cover up the smelly part of the canal. But it's it is a beautiful place. And speaking of Prosecco, you walk along and there are vendors who have carts just filled with ice and bottles and bottles and bottles of inexpensive Prosecco and rounds of cheese and then bags of Italian bread. It's a wonderful way to gondola through Venice. So,
oh, that's it. I'm in. Maybe we should do your show there.
We should. I think that's a great idea. Whose books do you like to read? You are a reader as well. I know that.
I am. Yeah.
So which books inspire you to want to write better, write more? Tell me a little bit about reading.
So it's no secret because this story is actually on my blog. But Nora Roberts was the first romance book I ever picked up. Jewels of the Sun, the Ardmore trilogy. I've always been a big literary. Yeah, I'd been a big literary book snob. I'd always read all of Oprah's book picks. I'd read The Reader and The Pilot's Wife and all these books. And I was stuck in a snowstorm in Chicago O'Hare Airport, and my plane wasn't taking off. And I went to the bookstore, and I thought, you know what? I just can't face another book where something dramatic and horrible happens. So I wandered over to the romance section, and I was like, oh, I'll just get one of these. And I devoured the book, and before I caught my flight, I bought the next two in the series, the other two in the trilogy. So that was where I started. J.C. Burton, I love the way she does series. Her play-by-play series was the series that made me go, I'm going to do this.
I'm reading something by her right now, as a matter of fact. Yeah.
The Hope series?
I don't know what the series is. It's just the new one. It's a new book. You know, it's a new book. I don't know.
Yeah, she writes amazing series, and she's very, very gracious.
The McCormack
yeah,
brothers?
Yeah.
Okay.
She's very, very gracious. And when I knew she was going to be at RWA, I reached out to her and said, you know what, you inspired me to do it. It was the day before my book launched. And I'm like, just want you to know, my book's coming out tomorrow, and you inspired me to do it. And I explained all the reasons why. And then I reloaded one of her books that I already had onto my Kindle so that when my book downloaded the next day, I could take a picture of the first play-by-play series next to my book. I know it's slightly dorky, but I just wanted that moment when I was next to J.C. Burton on my Kindle. And so I sent her the picture, and she not only did she retweet it, but she ended up meeting me for coffee at RWA and giving me all kinds of great career advice, which was really, really awesome. I also love Sydney Holston's mixed martial arts series, the Worth the Fight series. And then I have, I read all kinds of romance. So I don't just read contemporary romance. I actually like medieval historical. And so Catherine Levesque is one of my absolute favorite historical writers. And first of all, she's hugely prolific. So I'm constantly, asking her questions. How'd you manage to get, I think she's got like 11 books coming out this year or something crazy.
How did I do that? I don't understand that.
And they're so historically accurate. I mean, the level of detail in them is phenomenal. She weaves a great yarn, as my mom would say. But also, again, she's been incredibly gracious, and she asked me if I would write my novella for her, which is on Amazon Kindle Worlds. She was the first historical romance author to be given her own Kindle world. It's the world of the Wolf Pack. There are a whole bunch of phenomenal authors that she geared up to write in that world. But it's set on the wolf. And if you've read The Wolf at all, it actually has a contemporary epilogue. And, it echoes the historical story, but you get the sense that this love that these people had in medieval time was a love that lasted all of these lifetimes. And that anybody who descended from them was just destined to have this great romantic relationship in their life. And
how
so the
wonderful.
Epilogue was the first 5 or 10 pages of this, it's a Navy SEAL, Wade Wolf, and Nurse Jeremy Scatler. And she asked if I would write that novella for the launch of her Kindle world. And so, and it was with a bunch of phenomenal writers like Eliza Knight and Violetta Rand and Lena Williams and Anna Markland. There's just a huge group of phenomenal ladies. And so, not only do I admire Catherine tremendously as a writer and being very prolific, but you know, she's been very gracious. And again, the group of the Dwarf Ladies have so much more experience than I do. And yet they're always willing to give advice. And, you know, I'm like, hey, I'm up against this new thing that I haven't come across before. What do I do? You know, they'll all pitch in. We have an ongoing chat on Facebook. And so they'll all pitch in and help. So I do read Catherine Levesque. I've read everything of hers.
Okay, that's the longest quick answer I've ever heard.
I know, I'm
sorry.
I
have to move on to that. That's okay. We're running out of time, so I want to get in my final question, and that is, Scarlett, when were you comfortable enough to say, I'm an author?
The day my book went live on Amazon.
Good for you. Congratulations, yeah. Scarlett Cole, and wishing you so much success with Second Circle Tattoo Series.
Thank you.
First book, The Strongest Steel, was named by the director of book reviews for the Authors on the Air Global Radio Network as her book of the year. Please come back to my show. And like I say, I'm going to write a Nana letter to Tabitha and say, boy, did you miss out on someone spectacular. Cindy, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Yes, thank you, Cindy.
And I'll talk to you later,
Thank you.
Very
thank
much, you. Okay, bye-bye. And bye. Scarlett, thank you. Much, much luck. And you and I will be talking again, okay?
For sure. I look forward to it. Thanks for having me today.
Oh, it's been my honor and my pleasure. Have a great day and happy writing.
Thank you very much.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
And thank you, folks, for being with me this morning. Tabitha Pope will be back with you next week at her regularly scheduled time. Have a lovely day, everyone. Thank you.